said, amen. God bless you. You may be seated. Well, how many of you have ever had a word or a theme come up in such a repeated way in your life that you began to realize that there might be something more that God was asking you to pay attention to? Has that ever happened? Just a theme that comes up, or maybe it's even a number. Has anyone here ever experienced that you wake up at the same exact time every night? Has that ever happened to anyone? You say, why does that number keep coming up? And again, last week, there was something that began to unfold for me that I knew God was wanting me to pay attention to. And initially it happened last Monday with a conversation, and the word that came up, and I didn't recognize it at first, actually until the next day, but that word that came up was the word sanctuary. And again, it wasn't until the next morning that Robbie and I were actually praying together. It was very early, neither of us had gotten up yet, and I was hugging her very, very tightly as she prayed, and that I know that was a blessing to her. It was more of a blessing to me, actually. But anyway, I was praying, and as she was praying, I was holding her really, really tightly. And during her prayer, she thanked God for His love, and she thanked God for my love. And then she specifically mentioned how much she liked it when I held her. In her prayer, she mentioned how much she liked it when I prayed, or when I held her very, very tightly. And during her prayer, she said, God, it makes me feel safe and it makes me feel secure. All of a sudden, when she said that in her prayer, it hit me that God had highlighted the word sanctuary the night before. And I didn't really understand what that meant, and doing what I do, I love doing word studies. And when I got into the office that morning, I began to pray and really dig into that word sanctuary. I believe God began to stir something in me that He wanted me to listen closely to something that I hadn't learned yet, something He wanted to show me. And after that prayer time with Robbie, she said to me after the prayer time was over, she said, Doug, if there is one area where the devil attacks me more than any other area, it's in the area of insecurity. The area of insecurity. And so, again, I just continued to dig in further and say, God, what is that? And so, to be completely honest, feelings of insecurity can potentially slip in during any season of change or uncertainty. Feelings of insecurity absolutely will be used by the devil to grab us and take us into a place where God knows it's a dangerous place for us. I could go on with a long list of things that cause us to feel insecure, unsafe, or uneasy in some way. And so I want to camp out for a minute on the word sanctuary, and hopefully this will all begin to make more sense here as we progress this morning. But I got out my Webster's Dictionary, and I looked up the word sanctuary, and there's actually 5 different definitions that are associated with that word. The first word is a consecrated place. The second word is as follows: the most sacred part of a religious building, such as the part of a Christian church in which the altar is placed. So again, these are definitions of the word sanctuary. Next word, or the next definition: the room in which general worship services are held. Number 4, a place of refuge and protection. And number 5, a place of immunity from the law. And I'm thinking, okay, God, these all seem connected, but some of them, in some ways, seem very, very totally disconnected from one another. So, at first, as we dig in right now, I want us to look at the third definition of the word sanctuary. And that definition, I believe, is the definition that in our culture, most people, our Western church culture anyway, they would most readily associate that definition with the word sanctuary, and it's the room in which general worship services are held. This being a sanctuary. And so as I continued to pray and as I continued to think about it, this question popped up in my mind. Is our sanctuary a sanctuary? I want you to think about that for a minute. Is our sanctuary a sanctuary? Is this room in which general worship services are held a place of safety and refuge? Does the fullness of this word and God's definition of it apply to who we are and what takes place here? Does definition number 4 apply to us in this place at New Life Fellowship? Now let's look at definitions 4 and 5 together, and I want to provide some historical context, some biblically historical context. So I'm going to read in Joshua chapter 20, we're actually going to read just the first 6 verses. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Say to the people of Israel, appoint the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who strikes any person without intent or unknowingly may flee there. They shall be for you a refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and explain his case to the elders of that city. Then they shall take him into the city and give him a place, and he shall remain with them. And if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not give up the manslayer into his hand because he struck his neighbor unknowingly and did not hate him in the past. And he shall remain in that city until he has stood before the congregation for judgment, until the death of him who is the high priest at the time. Then the manslayer may return to his own town and his own home, to the town from which he fled." Now, in the Old Testament culture, in the Jewish culture, if I unintentionally was cutting wood and the axe head flew off and hit somebody and killed him, in that culture, the person or those who wanted to avenge the death of a friend or a loved one could legally come to me and take my life. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Okay, that's the Old Testament law. If somebody dies, somebody else has to die. But yet God, even in this Old Testament version of grace, said, "I'm going to provide a safe place, a place of safety and refuge for those who have sinned unknowingly, that even though within the law that person has to die, I'm still going to provide a place of safety and refuge for that person who can flee to that place." In the passage I just read, we can clearly see the principles associated with Webster's 4th definition, a place of refuge and protection. The spiritual principle of sanctuary is thousands of years old, but the deeper understanding has largely been lost. And I believe that God's idea and intent for sanctuary is for us to believe and know that genuine sanctuary, genuine safety, genuine refuge can never be found in a place. It can only be found in the person of Jesus. In our culture today, if you listen to the news much at all, you know there is wide political debate about sanctuary cities. The difference between the cities of refuge or sanctuary cities in the Old Testament and the sanctuary cities that we're establishing in many places today is that the sanctuary cities today are for people who are knowingly breaking the law. You say, "Well, I don't agree with that." Listen, this is not a political discussion today. This is not where I'm going, but I want you to understand people are fleeing abuse, they're fleeing certain things, and they're trying to find sanctuary in a place. They're trying to find sanctuary in a nation. And Jesus is saying, the only real true place of safety and refuge is found in me. That's it. It's found in me. I believe, in other words, that sanctuary is more than a geographical location. It's a spiritual location. God desires that we view sanctuary first and foremost as an inside-out place of refuge, not an outside-in place of refuge. In our humanity, we're always looking for someone, something, some provision, some resource to give us a sense of security that, okay, now I'm going to be okay. I want us to look at Psalm 46, and we're going to spend a little bit of time working through verses 1 through 11 here. But this idea that God desires that we view Him as a sanctuary, that we view Him as our place of safety, is found in the first verse of Psalm 46. Verse 1 says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Well, that word refuge in Hebrew means a place of shelter. God is our place of shelter. Do you see what he's saying here? I am your shelter. If you look at the New Testament, Jesus, the Son of Man, had no place to lay his head. He didn't have a physical shelter. He didn't have a physical place of safety and refuge. His Father was his shelter. His Father was his place of safety. His Father was his place of refuge. God is our refuge and strength. Now that Hebrew word for strength there is a fortress and a stronghold. A fortress and a stronghold. A very present help in trouble. Very present help in trouble. How many of you realize that God's presence is in the present? God's presence for you and I right now is not good enough to say what we had or what we experienced with Him 5 weeks ago or 5 years ago or 5 decades ago. God's presence is in the present. That's why his name is not I was. His name is I am. And the word I am, the description I am means right now. And then when you move into the future, I am right now. And when you move into the future, I am right now. I am. Verse 2, therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling, Selah. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. And here's our family life verse. Verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. Verse 7, the God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. Verse 11, the God of Jacob is our fortress, Selah. The first verse of Psalm 46 is clear in its message that any hope of finding a place of shelter, a fortress or a stronghold in anyone or anything but Him is a false hope. It's a false hope. Verse 11 reconfirms this reality. God is again described as a fortress. In Hebrew, the word is misgalb. It is defined as a cliff or a lofty, inaccessible place, a place of altitude, a refuge, a defense, a tower, or a high fort. How many of you have your bulletins? Look at the image on the front of the bulletin. This Hebrew definition of the word misgalb, a cliff or other lofty, inaccessible place, a place of altitude, a refuge, a defense, a tower, a high fort. So I'm looking at this. This past week, and Joshua and I talk about, you know, what is the image? Whether you guys realize it or not, every image on the front of our bulletin, we believe, has a message. We don't just come up with something, okay, here's a nice picture, let's throw that up there. See, the description of a cliff or a lofty, inaccessible place is not a description of a place that we can't climb to in order to reach God. This is really, really important that we get this and we understand this part of the message for sure. None of the rest of it will make sense if we don't get this. This cliff or lofty, inaccessible place isn't saying God is inaccessible for us. God is described as the place where we're with Him, and that place is inaccessible to those who would desire to do us harm. We are with Him in that place. It's not a place that, man, I can never get there. I can't get to where God is. He's too big for me. He's too far away from me. He's too far removed from me. I cannot get there. That is not what it's saying. God's saying, yes, I'm inviting you in. I want you here. I want you with me, and I will protect you. He is saying, I am the fortress. You're not in the fortress with me. I am the fortress. But we are always looking for the man-made fortress. We are always looking for that man-made or man-provided for place of safety and refuge. We all have experienced times in life when we got a raise at our job. Maybe we got a new job or a great investment opportunity came along. And with those things came the belief or the hope that maybe now, if this happens, I can feel safe. If I only had a raise, then I would be secure. If I could only get this relationship to work, then I would be secure. Most of us have also probably experienced a time when we discovered that circumstances we thought were stable suddenly weren't. What do we do in those circumstances? We begin to attempt at building our own fortress. We fall for the lie of the enemy that, okay, I got to take matters into my own hands and I've got to protect myself. And then we build our own fortress and we start putting up walls of protection because we want to feel safe on the inside while those we think may desire to do us harm or circumstances that we think may end up doing us harm, we've got to separate ourselves from that. And we build our own walls and we build that fortress that we think can protect us. What is our fleshly orchestrated, what do our fleshly orchestrated fortresses look like? Is it building up relational walls of separation? Or is it a savings account? Okay, I gotta have this money set aside in case something bad happens. When Robbie and I were getting ready to leave our hometown, I'd lived there, you guys have heard me say this before, I lived there for 45 years. It's just all I ever knew, and God began to stir some things in Robbie and I almost 10 years ago, and He began to let us know things were getting ready to change, and it was a scary time. And there was a verse or a passage that God used to really communicate to my wife, and it's in Isaiah 44. I remember the day when I was sitting in my office, and she called me just following this really massive revelation that God had given to her. In Isaiah 44, we're going to start reading at verse 9. It says, all who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do no profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know that they may be put to shame. And I want to stop very briefly here to look at the word idol in verse 9. All who fashion idols. How many of you know that anything that we worship or trust in place of God is an idol? Anything that we worship or trust in more than God is an idol. So hang on to that. Verse 10. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing. Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, the companions of the person who is trying to form and fashion this idol. And the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble, let them stand forth. They shall be terrified, they shall be put to shame together. The ironsmith takes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it into the figure of a man with the beauty of a man to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars. He chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and makes bread. He also makes a god and worships it. So these things that God made, man then takes and pulls it into his idea of what's going to be a good thing. So these beautiful trees that God has made, we take it, we cut it down, we use it for fuel, part of its fuel, the rest of it we begin to form an idol out of, and we go, oh, I can trust in this. Now let's not get hyper-focused on a piece of wood sitting on a mantle that we worship. Anything that we take that God has created, and we commandeer it, and we bring it into something that we can now trust in, it has become an idol. It becomes fuel for a man. He takes part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over half he eats meat and roasts it and is satisfied. Also he warms himself and says, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. He just made it with carpenter's tools. He just made it with his own hands and he said, look what I have done. I can trust in what I have done. Deliver me, for you are my God. Verse 18, they know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut his eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burned in the fire. I also baked bread on its coals. I roasted meat and have eaten. And shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart has led him astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, is there not a lie in my right hand? This thing that I have made that I worship is a lie in my right hand. And I can remember the day sitting in my office just a week or so before we were ready to move out of Cambridge. And my wife called me weeping. Because we were afraid. Our jobs were gone. Our income was gone. Our home was about to be gone. We didn't know where we were going. We didn't know God, what God was asking of us, but we knew God was speaking. And Robbie called me and she said, Doug, I was spending time with the Lord this morning and he confirmed to me our health insurance, our life insurance, our retirement plan, our savings account, our businesses, all of those things have become an idol that I've held in my right hand. And she and I both, this is not just about her, she and I both trusted in those things. We trusted in that stuff. I want to go back to Psalm 46 briefly, just one more time before we close, and I want to look at one final word. In verse 3, and then in verse 7, and then again, in verse 11, in verse 3, in verse 7, and verse 11, there's one word that's repeated three different times. Does anybody know what that word is? That word means a suspension of music a pause. A suspension of music and a pause. You say, okay, what does that mean? The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Stop. Stop. Hold on. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Think about it. The psalmist was saying, we can trust our God. We can trust our God when the enemies are attacking us. We don't have to climb the cliff and hope to get into that place of fortress. If those of us that are in Christ are already in the fortress. Think about it. Pause. Wait a minute. Can I ask you a question? Do we do that? When we get the phone call that our job is no longer secure, when we get the phone call that a family member has been diagnosed with cancer, when we get the phone call or the conversation, or the encounter that snatches our man-made support system out from underneath us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Think about it. I believe that God is asking us to pause and reflect on His trustworthiness in the midst of scary circumstances. He's bigger than anything we will ever face. He is our sanctuary. Is our sanctuary a place of safety and refuge? Our sanctuary, our fortress, a mighty fortress, is our God. He is our refuge. Do we believe that? Really, really, really. Do we believe that? I'm not talking about, John Wesley used to talk about mental ascent. And mental ascent is when we say, oh yeah, mighty God is our fortress. Yay, Jesus. Oh no. I don't know if we'll get through this. I don't know if we'll get over this scary circumstance in our life. Listen, I'm not preaching at you and I'm not dogging anybody. I fight the same battles you guys do. Same battles. And specifically, I'm talking about the battles of fear and doubt and unbelief. That is God really, truly? I am. God right now. Things don't make any sense to us. I'd like to have the worship team come forward if you would. I'd like to have us all stand this morning. How many of you would honestly say, in the middle of really, really hard stuff, in the middle of really, really hard, scary stuff, how many of you would honestly say, I don't really act like God is my fortress when it really gets hard. I don't do it. You know what we say? when it gets really, really hard, here's what we say. I got to figure something out. I got to figure something out. I got to work something out. I got to do something. That's called striving. It's not called trusting. And I don't know about you guys, I find it really, really difficult to take a step back. Say, God, you're really, really big. You're really, really, really big. And you really, really, really love us. So I think, God, I'm going to wait on you. They that wait upon the Lord. Shall mount up on wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. They that wait upon the Lord, I believe, will hear His voice. And then instead of us trying to figure something out, we can get on our knees and say, God, would you lead me? Would you guide me? Would you speak to me, Father? Because I can't do this. I can't do this. But you can do this. Because you're big. And you are right now. I am God. I can't even imagine what would happen among a body of believers who would say, we're going to wait on the Lord. We're going to wait on Him. He's trustworthy. I'm not going to trust in the idol that I've made with my own hands, my career, my financial safety net. I'm going to trust you, God. So you guys know, we talked about this a few months ago when the children of Israel left Egypt. The Egyptians gave them all their wealth. They were literally giving them gold and silver. They were giving them every massive amounts of money by today's standards. They were giving them this huge amount of wealth. But how many of you know that that wealth was worthless to them when they were standing at the Red Sea, not knowing if they were going to die there on the shore? That wealth meant nothing to them. Because when you and I have a Red Sea moment, nothing and no one but the great I Am is going to meet your need. That's it. So, Father, right now we are coming to you and we are thanking you that you are the great I Am. You're big. And, Lord, there was a lot of honest people that immediately put their hands up and they said, when life gets hard, when it gets difficult, they don't really view you as their fortress. God, I confess to you that I come in and out of it. I come in and out of it. There's days that I really, really do, and there's other days I'm saying, God, what in the world is going on? If there's anyone in this place today that would say, God hasn't been my fortress, and I haven't trusted Him like I should, and I'd just like to come stand in front of this altar today and confess that. The Bible says, confess your faults before men. Not outwardly, not verbally. You don't have to say anything. I just want to come up here and say, I haven't trusted God as my fortress, but beginning today, I want things to be different. I want things to be different. I want things to change. Because I'm telling you, when we, as a body of believers, can say, yeah, God, you're big. You're big. And I want to trust you, God. Until we can get to the place as a body of believers where we say, yeah, I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to be transparent and say, I need Jesus in a big way in my life. I believe God's going to stand in the shadows and He's going to let us do our thing. I want Him to show up in a powerful way. Worship team.